RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with royal designers.
There is a moment in theatre when the audience settle, the house lights go down, and we are invited to enter into another world. And for a brief moment in our busy lives, we suspend our disbelief. A large part of the artifice of theatre is the set design and the costumes worn by the characters. My guest today has spent three decades helping to create the magic that is theatre, and in 2008 was recognised for her services to theatre with an MBE. Sue Blaine came to public notice with a wild and wacky production that at first sight she didn't care for or felt the inclination to work on. But she did, for a pittance. That production was the Rocky Horror Show, and the rest is history. Join me now to listen in on a conversation that I had with Sue at her home in Dorset. In it, she reveals that although she has been a professional designer for over 30 years that spans theatre, opera, musicals and film, she still has self-doubt and those first night nerves. One of the things I wanted to kick off with is the fact that since 1972, the combined total of the various productions you've been involved with, that's both production design and costume, is 82. So that seems to more or less give you about, you know, two, maybe three a year. And that's over a 35-year period. You were made a royal designer in...
It was 2005.
In 2007, you were made an MBE for your services to drama. And a little bit of frivolity. I checked, you're a Taurian, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
So I was interested to know whether the characteristics of Taurians fitted you. Apparently, they never do things quickly. They don't like making snap decisions. They hate change, are extremely creative, love flowers, music and opera, and they're most suited to a practical career. They're highly amusing, quite outrageous in appearance, but underneath the crazy exterior is a background of true talent and very hard work. Would you say that that's kind of
something? Goodness. Well, some of it's a little immodest to agree to, but in principle, that's very interesting, the last bit you read out. Certainly, I'm very conscious in my work, and have always been, that I love the blend of creative and practical. And I think I mentioned this to you before, that one of the things that thrilled me about becoming a designer for industry, with or without the royal bit, was the fact that I really value industrial elements of pure design. Debatable whether theatre design, as with many of our, what do we call them, our areas of design, are actually pure design or applied art. I think that's a huge debate and always has been. But I do feel that there's a sort of industrial element to, certainly to theatre design and to many of the other disciplines that are handled within our faculty. And I think that gives wonderful scope for all sorts of things. And I didn't watch it very much last night because I'd recorded it and it was a little bit late, but I videoed the piece about the Airbus 380.
Oh, yes.
And I think that...
It's fascinating.
Absolutely fascinating. And I think that's going to be, when I sit down and watch it properly, I just skim through it. I think that's going to embody a lot of those beautiful things that we love about our industries. No, I think it does. And certainly, I can make quick decisions once I'm on the run. You know, once I'm confident and the initial design process is over, and, for instance, in the case of costumes, if I'm actually in a costume fitting and, you know, we're looking at details or there's something radically not working or whatever, then I can move fast then. But it's a long process to get to the confidence of then being able to be sure of what I'm doing.
Well, we'll talk about how,
so
you,
that
how,
is
you,
accurate.
How you get to that confidence.
But that's certainly accurate.
What I wanted to just touch on right now, before going sort of backwards, as it were, is what you've been doing more recently. Now, I know you've been involved with the David Bintley's production in Japan of Aladdin. And I know that you have worked with him before because he was at the Birmingham Royal Ballet as artistic
Correct.
Director.
Correct, he is
and he's
still.
Now, he's still. And he's yes. also, is he not director of the National Ballet?
He is. Unusually, he's the artistic director of two companies as of... He took over the Japan one in December.
Mm. So could you tell me, just tell me a little bit about the Aladdin production in Japan, and I think there was a possibility it might come here.
Fingers crossed on that one, Mike. Birmingham Royal Ballet, obviously, it's David's choreography, but also their technical department and their chief executive went to see the production in Japan and loved it. I think they'd very much like to put it into their season, but they have to raise the money for it. That's the thing. Sure. I mean, it's they're expensive things. Mm. But fingers crossed on that, I really hope so. The production itself is a full three-act classical ballet. Mm. Absolutely beautiful, beautiful choreographically. And even though I say it myself, pretty good-looking as well. Mm. And Dick Bird designed the set, mm. and Marco Jonathan designed the lighting. And it all came together, as ever, at the last minute, mm. in the most spectacular fashion. For mm. us all, we were all really, really thrilled with it. It's very, as I say, it's very beautiful, it's very moving. Bintley's work is always on the edge of eccentric and entertaining. Mm. So there's some very funny things in it as well. Mm. But the sort of lyricism of it is magnificent. And the music is stunning. It's by Carl Davis. He wrote the score... I think about 8 or 9 years ago. And in fact, there was a version done at Scottish Ballet, but it was, I think it was much smaller and it was done contemporary.
Right.
So it doesn't bear any relation to this one.
And I guess in terms of, if you are fortunate isn't it, and it comes over to Birmingham, will there be very much work for you to do on a transfer?
I'll be absolutely honest with you, I don't know.
No.
Because what I haven't done is had time to catch up with David
yeah.
as to whether he would make any major changes to it.
Yeah.
Because obviously it's a first run.
Of course.
And he may have things that he radically wants to change. And also what I don't know is whether the actual physical costumes, I didn't do the set for this, would be available to use here. If it was a case of having to remake everything mm. so that Birmingham had its own permanent production, if you like, that
sure.
it could roll out whenever it wanted to, then probably I'd make some changes
yes.
because my taste would have changed by
of
then.
Course. Of course.
But yeah. actually, as a piece, if it came over exactly as it was in Japan in November, I'd be delighted.
I'm going to go back long before November coming. I'm going to go way back to when you were a child. You were born, you're a child of the 50s. Course.
So, definitely.
So I'd like to know what your early influences were. I mean, what were you like as a child? Just tell me a little bit about your...
Probably classic Victorian. I was always happy with my own company in that I could imagine things. Mm. I grew up in a most, most fortunate way. I'm one of the luckiest people.
So tell me how.
I had, and still have, a wonderful father. I had, until 5 years ago yesterday, an absolutely magnificent mother, mm-hmm. a dearly beloved sister who lives just up the road. And we lived in a fabulous house in the countryside.
Whereabouts?
It was in Shropshire, mm-hmm. on the very borders of Shropshire and Staffordshire.
Mm-hmm.
I was born in Wolverhampton, in fact, but we moved out to the countryside when I was about 7, I think it was. And I had a very, very luxurious childhood. I was very happy. I was a bit of a loner. There's no mm-hmm. question about that. And I started drawing, like little girls do, horses and ballet dancers and things, when I was about 5, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't very good. Mm-hmm. But it always kept me amused. And I used to be quite a tomboy as well. I love climbing trees and all that kind of thing. And I also grew up overlooking a railway. And that was just wonderful. It was steam trains then. And
so
I,
railway children.
Totally, yes. I mean, I used to spend a lot of time. I had a swing on a big oak tree up on the embankment and I could see, just watch the trains go by. And it was then still a very well-used route, which was the Holyhead route.
Oh, yes.
From from the southeast, in fact. So it was a, you know, we got big trains.
Yes.
Very handsome. In fact, we had some sort of memorable train incidents, and it was great. It was great.
And your sister, was she older or younger?
She's older, 2.5 years older. She also is very practical minded. I mean, we're both quite keen DIY and doers, and we don't, neither of us really fit into the kind of sit down and relax thing. For me, that comes, and probably did even then, comes with the creative side. That's where I get my relaxation from, probably, is either discussing things with people, and, you know, in adult life it involves dinner and drinks and things like that, or reading or things like that. But the other, it is very, when you mentioned the Taurus, it's very clear-cut to me that I'm literally half of me would have liked to be an engineer or a sculptor, and the other half is a
thoughtful
and imaginative and what about softer side.
And what about your parents? What did they?
Neither of them had any artistic blood per se. My father was in the manufacturing business. He and his brother and his father before him had a lock manufacturing business in Wolverhampton, which made very beautiful luggage locks, brass, you know, traditional, beautifully made.
Very, very practical.
Very practical, indeed. Yeah. He was on the sales side, but again, he'd always been practical. I mean, he did all of, you know, DIY, always painted houses, mended cars, you know, so did a lot of outside activity. That strand was from him, On my mother's side, she had an engineering background as well, very obviously from the Midlands. And in fact, she was a very beautiful young woman, went before I knew her, and I think she was beautiful right up until she passed away. But she, in fact, during the war, she went and worked with Rolls-Royce in the hope of becoming a test pilot, which was quite sort of adventurous. I've still got all her notebooks downstairs, actually, which are fascinating, absolutely fantastic. I've yet to archive those, get them to the Imperial War Museum, I think. But in fact, she never achieved it because after 8-9 months of the war, I think they realised they must use pilots who could no longer do the actual missions to keep sort of morale up, and also they were better trained, probably.
Yeah.
So she went on to maintenance for quite a while. So she had a very practical side to her. She was an excellent cook. She didn't work. She ran the household perfectly. On her side, there's quite a lot of artistic elements around. The key one being, although I never knew him, and when I was young, I wasn't aware of him so much, my great-great uncle was, in fact, Edwin Cross, who was a member of the Royal Academy. That's one of his paintings there, which is of my great-great-grandmother. That's another of his there.
There's something in the family.
And on her maternal side, my mother's side, she came from a family of very, very keen embroiderers and, you know, they're artistic in that slightly old-fashioned feminine sense.
Yes.
But certainly it was there. I had several aunts who did magnificent embroideries and
what about your
things.
Early schooling? What was that?
That's not so good.
Not.
That was the downside of living in the country. I went to a weekly boarding school in Birmingham. My sister was already there. I went relatively young. I went at 8. And I think nobody thought anything of it then. I think my parents both believed that we would be getting a really good education. They realised by then their family was going to be 2 girls as opposed to boys. So they put all their energies and indeed finances into sending us to what they considered a very good school. I made it okay in the end, but I was not happy. I really didn't like school, I must admit. I had some nice friends ultimately, but I really didn't like it. It did not suit me.
So when, because you later went on to Wolverhampton College of Art, so tell me about the transition into that world. When did you start to feel that you wanted to go down that route?
Quite early. I think I absolutely knew probably by my early teens that I wanted to do something creative. I didn't know what, of course. I continued to have a genuine interest in drawing and painting, and I academically I wasn't particularly good. I got 5 O levels, which is not great. One of which was in art, and I did flourish in art. I played quite a bit of sport as well in those days. But the art side was strong. And I was fortunate enough, in my opinion, to be able to leave school at 16 and enter an art college, which I think I was probably the last year that could do that, actually. Certainly, by 1966, I enrolled for Wolverhampton College of Art and had an inspired tutor, absolutely wonderful, called Bill Kimpton, who's no longer with us. And he was just wonderful. And I did 2 years of what we then called pre-diploma, but was actually foundation course, as instead of doing A-levels.
So you would be finding a direction during that foundation.
Yes.
What did you...
I didn't know.
You didn't
I loved everything.
You did, yes.
I loved printing, I loved sculpture, I loved textiles, I loved the fine art, I loved absolutely everything about the foundation course just blew me away,
I recently,
perhaps the same for you.
I recently interviewed Roger Law of Spitting Image fame, and he said that when, I mean, his background was not dissimilar, that it was in the country in Norfolk, and when he went to college in the same very similar way, he had an artistic bent and didn't really know what he wanted to do. He said it was like waking up and going to heaven for him.
Yes, that's a lovely way of putting it. It's a totally liberating thing. In many respects, I've never done military training or anything like that, but I think any of these big things happen, they are life-changing. And I think if somebody didn't know what to do with their life, didn't particularly want to go through sport or through commerce or whatever, then quite frankly, you wouldn't be wasting your time to do a foundation course, because it's just fabulous. It's so varied, as you remember, and just the simple principles of learning about colour. And
as you say, it's great to have a tutor who gives you some direction.
Yes.
Inspiring. Because
that's
not so much the case, I think, these days. I think many students are very much left and they're lacking in that sort of inspirational tutor, those special
people. I think possibly. And also how many people are lucky enough to meet somebody who just absolutely can guide them anyway. And he was terrific. I mean, the main thing he was disciplined. And he taught me and all the other students in our class. He said, the thing is, you're not to give up. He said, if you know, everybody has bad times. Like, you know, I can get hysterically, manically upset about work I'm doing and always have been able to, and go into deep, deep depressions. And he just kept saying, no, don't stop. Just make that, if it's a drawing, you've got to make it work. You can't not make it work as long as you don't give up on it. It'll turn into something. You might hate what it turns into, but it will turn into something, as opposed to you just throwing it away because you don't think it's very good. And that was an extraordinary lesson to learn. I think I'm very undisciplined in my life and in my work, and that's probably counteracted by, frankly, panic, you know, deadlines. I think that's why I also really perhaps should only ever have done theatre, where you've actually got a deadline, you've got to get something out.
Well, after your 2 years in foundation at Wolverhampton, you came to a point where you needed to decide what to do next. You went on to Central.
That's right. Well, that basically was also quite fun, actually, because I honestly didn't know what to do. I was in a real state. I was very keen to go down the sculpture route. I was very interested in graphics. And I'd by then become very interested in textiles and things as well. And I really couldn't make it's a huge decision. You must remember yourself what to go and take your, what is now a degree course in. And I literally overheard somebody in a corridor mention theatre design, and I had never heard of it. I didn't know there was such a thing. And so I went to see Bill Kimpton. I said, what's theatre design? And he said, oh, it's, you know, things to do with old costumes and, you know, period design and you make set designs as well. And I thought, my goodness, that sounds all right.
So had you had no interest in the theatre? You hadn't been exposed to much?
No, I'd been a couple of times.
Yeah.
Been to a panto when I was little and...
So you had no... Apart from, you know, set design, costume, you never...
No, I didn't know that existed.
I would have thought you would have been a child that went to lots of musicals or
not at all.
No, that's...
Mind you, having said that, I loved movies on the telly.
Yeah.
We went to a few in the cinema, but living in a country, again, you don't go that often. But I loved movies on telly. I loved particularly old 1940s, 50s movies and 30s as well.
So you
all the black and white stuff, because we had a black and white telly.
So, you would have actually entered Central the late 80s, the late 60s.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I came out of Wolverhampton in 68 and went to Central.
And so you were there for a three-year period?
3 years, yes, absolutely.
And going through that, and you started to concentrate very much on theatre design.
Yes, it was a theatre design course run at that time by the wonderful colleague of RSA, Ralph Coltai.
Of course, yes.
Who, again, was an inspiration to me.
Yes.
He had a wonderful impact, I think, because he wasn't that hands-on at teaching, in inverted commas.
Yeah.
But, of course, he was always busy with his own wonderful work, doing ring cycles here and plays there. And he did most of that work in the college.
So we were kind of, he
had a lot of assistance on set design. Robin Don worked with him a lot then. But, quite often there'd be a huge great model sitting in his office. And he was he had a lovely way of basically just sneaking round and looking at what people were doing and then assessing them. And he'd nearly always come into the studios after most people had gone home. And if you were lucky enough to stay on, you'd get a half-hour chat with Ralph, which was magic.
And, of course, he was doing very cutting-edge work.
In
theatre.
Yes.
Really almost abstract, quite dramatic stuff.
Yes, he turned...
Very inspirational, I'm sure.
He changed the sort of face of theatre design in many respects, I think.
Yes.
And so we were seeing that, not necessarily doing it, but we were seeing it.
Yes.
And the whole hierarchy of the three-year courses is, of course, you're seeing the other 2 years ahead of you and what they're doing, and then you're in the same... I think art school or probably university must be the same. It's just a wonderful, wonderful way of learning. We didn't actually learn to do theatre design as such, because, like most arts, you can't actually teach somebody to...
Yeah.
You know, you can teach the practical elements of it, but the creative side you've got to come up with. There is a big difference with theatre, of course, is you're working to either a script or music or whatever, so there's a kick-off point, which is perhaps where it absolutely isn't, could not be considered a fine art.
Mm. Well, then of course, you get to a point in this process of design education, and of course, it ends, and that's when the adventure really begins.
Yes.
So tell me, I think your beginnings certainly, I think, were with the Glasgow Citizens Theatre.
Absolutely.
And you did, I think, seven productions with them.
I did.
Between 72 and 75.
Yes, I actually was incredibly lucky. I mean, so fortunate in that Philip Prowse, who was at that time, he was the head of design at the Citizens Theatre. Giles Havergal was the artistic director, along with Robert David MacDonald. They ran the theatre between the three of them. But obviously, Philip Prowse is, anybody in the arts knows, is high style and art. And he came to our degree show in 1971, and he wanted an assistant designer, and he decided to take on two. And he interviewed, after the show, myself, Maria Bjornsson, and David Fielding, another great designer. Mm. And Philip decided to take Maria and myself as a sort of double act. We were great friends at college anyway. She was, in fact, a year ahead of me. She was in her second year when I was in my first year. Mm-hmm. But in typical Maria fashion, she didn't think she'd learnt enough, so she stayed on an extra year. And in that, in her fourth year and my third year, we became very close friends.
Right.
Mainly because we moved our studio onto the paint frame in the Janetta Cochrane, so we could work weekends and things like that. And we just got on really well. It was great fun. So that was a very special thing to get to be offered a job at the Glasgow Citizen and with your best friend.
Yeah.
Doesn't get much better than that.
So you were actually there in Glasgow?
Yes, we both started at the same time, which must have been this early September. I don't honestly remember. And we did a complete year of so-called assisting. But again, luckily, which was fantastic, Philip was very keen that his so-called assistants actually didn't do that much assisting for him, except on a practical level with painting and, you know, breaking down our costumes and things like that. But the main thing was that we would actually have our own design work initially together. Maria and I designed our first big show, which was Galileo and Brecht, together. I then leant much more towards set and Maria much more towards costumes. That changed later. But yes, we did a complete year together, and then I think Maria did, I think she left after the year and moved back down to London, and I stayed on for another 6 months or so working at the sits, again, designing pieces for myself as well. And then I was invited back fairly regularly once I'd moved back down to London.
And of course, when you were back in London in, I guess, 73...
I think it was about 73. Yeah. Yes, it was.
You then, of course, the project that's followed you around for, for the last 30-odd years, which is the Rocky Horror
that's
Show.
That's right.
Which... you know, became, which was originally at the Royal Court Theatre upstairs.
That's right. 50-seater, I think it was.
Yeah, which of course became a piece of history all around because later became the Rocky Horror Picture Show as well, for which you did. Now, I was interested to read, going through some background on you, where you were, when you first, you know, I think read the script or was talking about the Rocky Horror Show. You said you thought the story sounded awful. You had no desire to design a lot of drag costumes for no money.
More or less true.
But you had enough work at the time.
I tell you what the background of that is as well, is that there's a wonderful woman called Harriet Cruikshank, who now is a producer and very, very well-established agent, but she produces as well now. She at the time was running the Royal Court Theatre upstairs, and I'd known her from the Citizens. And she got my number, I think, from Philip, my London number, and she rang me up and said, "Sue, please, 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 would you consider designing a show for us? You're my last hope. I've tried anybody who's any good, and they've all turned it down."
Good.
Great compliment, great gambit, start. Yeah. She said, "Please, please, please, if nothing else, just see the directors to stop him plaguing me to find a costume designer." And so I agreed to it. It was a very rainy Saturday, and Jim Sharman, the director of Rocky Horror, came round to see me in my tiny little studio that I then had. And we just hit it off. Like it was just immediate fun.
And you apparently had a minuscule budget for these.
It was tiny, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it was. So was the fee.
Yeah, so presumably that...
was 50 quid, which I shared. I halved that with Colin McNeil, dear beloved Colin McNeil, who was the... at the time, they would have called him wardrobe master, but he was the main costume maker at the Citizens, and I managed to get him to come down and help me to get through this mad piece.
And presumably you had to cut your cloth because with very little money you had to find...
Well, a lot of it we just borrowed from the sits.
Yeah.
And a lot of it we found, some things we bought, and we sort of vaguely made some things as well, which was... It turned into great fun, but I must admit on paper it didn't sound enticing. I mean, it sounded interesting, but, you know, I didn't think it would really work. Yes. A lot of other people did. Yes. I mean, certainly Sharman thought it would work.
Yes.
A wonderful, wonderful set designer, Brian Thompson, Australian, again, as is Jim Sharman. Richard O'Brien's a New Zealander. by birth. And we worked together a lot, actually, after that. It was a great kick-off from that point of view as well.
Well, just moving on from that, with the Rocky Horror Show, obviously you became then more known for costumes. Mm. Suddenly you were a costume designer.
Exactly. Up until then, I'd done either only sets. Maria and I did a lot of work together, where I did, this was mainly for Scottish Opera, actually, with... under the leadership of David Pountney.
Yep.
And I would design the sets and Maria the costumes. Mm. And that all swiveled on its head eventually. And also from Maria's point of view, she got to a point where she just didn't actually really enjoy doing costumes so much. So she made it a rule that she would never do just costumes again.
Right.
So that obviously changed that a little bit. And certainly Rocky... I became known as a costume designer in rather a strange way, really. But because of the opera work and everything else, I was still doing a lot of period-type shows as well. So,
I mean...
So it was a nice blend, actually.
And the kind of contrast between, you know, the costumes for Rocky Horror Show, which are kind of outrageous and, you know, surprising. You then, a few years later, you were asked by Peter Greenaway to produce the costumes for The Draftsman's Contract, which was, at the time, a visually stunning film. And interestingly, I went last week to see, at the British Film Institute, Barry Lyndon.
Ah, beautiful film.
Which, I have to say, I'd only seen small sections of it on video. Hopeless way to watch Barry Lyndon. But I watched the 2.5 hours of Barry Lyndon last week, totally captivated. Mm. About everything, actually.
That was a groundbreaking film, beautiful. I think, wasn't it?
And the costumes were...
Is that Tom Rand? Have I got that right?
No, it was Melina Calonero and Ulla Britt Solderen, I think it's the name. The two, they both won Oscars, joint Oscars for the costumes. But there was sort of connection in that because I was so freshly aware of Barry Lyndon, and I watched Draftsman's Contract last night and looked at your costume. Very interesting that yours... were very pared down. You used incredible simplicity. You know, there were lots of blacks and whites, or whites with oranges, all the way through. You used it in a very graphic way, which I thought was very effective. And yet, often the close-ups with wigs and so forth were kind of verging on the outrageous.
Yes,
it was a very interesting...
It was a good-looking film,
beautiful.
I have to say.
Very beautiful.
And I must also give credit. I mean, there's lots of things that I've designed... and lots of parts of Rocky for which I completely can credit myself. But nothing comes without influence. Mm. And certainly the concept of Rocky, putting everybody in their underwear and all of that, was worked out between myself and Jim Sharman. So in a way it's original to both of us. But I wouldn't have done that without Jim's brief, if you see what I mean.
Yes.
And the same with something like Draftsman's Contract. Greenaway was almost specific about
about
the brief.
Yes.
And certainly he mentioned last year in Marion Bad, and that's what he was really remaking.
Of course.
And also he didn't want it to be Barry Lyndon.
Yeah.
You know, because
he
wanted it much sharper.
The last year in Marion Bad.
Yes.
I mean,
you can see it, can't you?
Now I can.
Yes.
Very graphic.
So he was very, very strong about that. He was also again, a wonderful, wonderful kind of influence. He was very, very strong on keeping to the concept, not letting me waver. Another wonderful director, John Caird, said, "Oh, you're the only person I know that can talk yourself out of a good idea." You know, and it is true.
Well,
that's the confidence thing again.
It's the job of a director, isn't it, to direct?
And yes.
The thing that I think anyone listening to this has to realise about working within... whether it's film or theatre, is that it is not often, it is a collaborative process.
Yes.
Obviously, you're selecting people who are extremely good in the different departments.
Yes.
But ultimately, it is a collaboration between people. And I want to talk about that a little bit later. But
no, very strongly said. And certainly in the case of Draftsman, Peter Greenaway, he actually absolutely said, no, you know, stick to it, keep it clean. Black and white and all the rest of it. He said, I want it to look absolutely wonderfully period and, you know, all the rest of it. And for instance, there's a complete actual, what do I call it, not mistake, it's a deliberate flouting of historical accuracy in that the wide panniers of the women's costumes,
yes,
and the period that the piece is set in are completely mismatched.
Yes.
In other words, they didn't exist then.
So artistic.
Totally artistic. Yeah. But again, Peter said, no, let's go for it. It's not, we're not after historical accuracy. We want to feel we are.
Mm.
And I'd learnt this also from before and afterwards working on Shakespeare pieces, particularly in the smaller theatres, that quite often historical accuracy is actually misleading, and it's better to invent it for yourself, and it's more fun, and you can make it read to an audience. So, for instance, the whole development of what the draftsman's costume actually was, with all those frills,
yes,
underneath it and everything, I don't think that ever existed, but it made it kind of, it was my way of imagining how the stylized,
yes,
shapes were formed.
And very interestingly, there was a film, again, a few years before that, called The Duelist, which was Ridley Scott's first film.
Which I don't think I ever saw, actually.
Well,
I do apologise.
It's interesting simply because he, I remember at the time, the main characters wore tiny little plaits that hung down the side, which I don't think were accurate at all, but they looked fantastic. So I think the idea of putting in your own artistic sort of license is...
Makes
for a very special,
yes,
film. I think if you're just a slave to accuracy, it just...
Well, I never have been. I mean, I have to say, I'm pretty good on my historical knowledge, and I'm pretty... That was the other thing I didn't mention earlier on, actually. It's funnily enough, the one subject I loved at school, absolutely loved, was history.
Ah.
And I'd forgotten that as a link.
Oh,
that's
well,
a very strong one.
Yeah.
And also growing up in the country and actually a very short bicycle ride away from the White Ladies Priory, where King Charles hid in the oak tree.
Mm.
I always would have been a royalist, I'm absolutely certain of that. But I sort of had a real fascination with Charles II.
Ah.
And apart from anything else, all the portraits of him make him look so handsome.
Yeah.
And that comes right back into Draftsman's Contract.
Okay,
I mean, it's absolutely there.
And was it, as a result, I mean, after Draftsman, which got a lot of critical acclaim at the time, and visually it was featured everywhere, you went on and did quite a long period for the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Yes.
Was there a connection there, or was that simply...
No, I don't know that there was, really. I think it was just my time. I'm trying to remember how... The first piece I did for the RSC was Ben Jonson, Every Man in His Humour.
Yes, in 86.
In the Swan,
then
newly built Swan Theatre.
And then you had a pretty good run. I mean, it sort of dipped
yes,
in
I did a lot.
The National Theatre and Royal Shakespeare.
Yes. I think it's just names start to just come up. It's and people ask you to do things and see your work.
I also watched, I watched Porgy and Bess, and I was very interested in that because, you know, you have this reputation for kind of being, and I think it all stems from the thing that is stuck to you, which is Rocky. And I was pleasantly surprised to discover that your work is incredibly varied, and it's not in any shape or form, locked into one particular sort of outrageous, whenever I read pieces about you, they talk about, leopard skin and your love of that, so which is absolutely fine. But looking at Porgy and Bess, I thought that was such a beautiful range of costumes. And watching the opera itself, the sheer volume of people
is spectacular.
The massing, the blocking of the people together with all these different costumes, even down to things like unstructured collars on shirts, which from the back of the theatre you wouldn't even see, but it was the detail in that I thought was extraordinary. It really did work very well.
Well, the brief for Porgy, and indeed this is a nice link up with the Shakespeares, because the Shakespeares, I always hope to do them with wit, but certainly the Shakespeares, the first Ben Jonson piece, and we went on to do another one. John Caird and myself, the director, we very much wanted it to become real.
Mm.
I was very worried about the Everyman in His Humour because I found it very difficult to read on the page. And John said, oh, don't worry. He said, just think of it like The Archers. He said, it's exactly the same. He said, it's up to me to make the script work. Don't you worry about that. You just have fun designing it. But, and again, one invented realistic details that, you know, for all we know, absolutely never happened, yes. And made it all very accessible and rich and period. And with Porgy and Bess, it, from Trevor Nunn's brief, and from the work that had already started with John Gunter on the set, the absolute prime important thing was that we believed these people and that we believed them with dignity. Mm. Because even in whenever we did it, which was in about 86, I suppose, might have been even earlier.
It was 93.
93, all right. Later than I thought. No, it wasn't. It was much earlier. The filming of it might have been 93.
Yes, I think
the actual production, yeah, which we did for Glyndebourne originally,
yes,
was in the mid-80s. And even then, particularly doing a wonderful piece of opera like Gershwin's, there was still a little bit of an edge just in the opera world as to whether it really was an opera or whether it was a musical.
Oh, yeah.
And to be doing it with an entirely black cast, which is it's absolutely obligatory within the copyright of doing the opera, which is wonderful, apart from four white parts in it. Doing that at Glyndebourne was quite radical in its own right. And so Trevor was absolutely passionate that we just knock people's eyes out with the tragic situation these people are in, and just so the absolute naturalism of it was paramount.
I think that's what struck
me. It was very important.
It was very, very naturalistic. And obviously, I've only seen the film version, which was, as you say, made later. But what struck me, you know, having been involved with opera myself for, you know,
of course, with all the E&O.
I was, you know, I understand. You know, what I think a lot of people don't realise is it's probably the most expensive art form anyway to put
it
together.
It probably
simply
is.
Simply because of the sheer volume of people on stage.
Yes.
So, you know, the ticket price, for example, which people always moan about, one can understand it. You're there often. I mean, for example, I was looking at your production stills from Wagner's Lohengrin, which is
which is spectacular, isn't it?
Which I think is Stefanato's...
That's right. Another wonderfully eminent... Royal Designer for Industry.
Well, I've seen many of his productions at E&O, of course, and they're always spectacular. But your production with him of Lohengrin and your costumes, particularly that very, you know, double horizontal set where you've got a top row of beautiful soldiers in what look like sort of pre-Raphaelite versions of armour, suits of armour, very ornate and beautifully lit, holding these sort of...
They were extraordinary. They were... apart from, obviously, I give a huge credit on the Lohengrin, particularly to Keith Warner, who was the director, and Stefan Lazaridis. I couldn't have made my way through that conceptually, and I had trouble with it. Mm. I really had trouble with it. And they both very bossy, if you like. They both said, no, it'll work. Come on, get on with it, you know. Is this how, you know, keep it surreal, keep it this. Mm. They were incredibly influential about what it actually looked like.
Well, it looks fantastic.
And it came off a treat. I mean, but I floundered on that one, floundered a lot. But in the end, I had a huge backup from the people in the actual production side in Bayreuth as well. They were tremendous. I mean, all production departments are wonderful. Mm. But they supported me enormously. It was not an easy route. But it certainly paid off. It was extraordinary. But something like they're the Brabant's chorus of the old soldiers. Mm. I'd just recently got a computer, and it was my first show really where I managed to make the computer do something that I couldn't do.
I know you did a bit of distortion
yes,
and blurring.
I was desperate. I hadn't designed them, and Stefan and Keith were coming around to have a look at the designs, and I was going absolutely tearing my hair out. I was terrified. I thought, oh, they're going to kill me. I'm done. So I just panicked for an afternoon and put this thing together on the computer. And they just went, oh, my God, that's fantastic. So then the problem was how to make that for real.
Yeah.
And in the end, we had the armour itself was made of vac-formed plastic all from mold.
Yes.
But this brilliant man in Munich, he said, oh, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll do the main body of it in solid vac form. He said, and then I'll do a see-through vac form and I'll offset it. So you get this ghosting.
Yes, yes.
And then sprayed into it.
Which you achieved on the computer.
Yes,
because
I did, that's right.
And it does look extraordinary.
It's
amazing.
It was a real thrill. Absolutely, it was a real thrill. And also the writing on the cloaks and things. We did all that in the end on organza. And so they had this sort of old script.
Well, as we go into the last 15 minutes of this interview, I want to just talk a little bit about the process of what you go through. You know, the initial concept and then the development and then leading to production, because I think it will be useful for people to understand those different stages, because ultimately when it leads to production, there are many things you have to be aware of, which, you know, which are behind the scenes. And it's about, can you break this set down because there's another one coming on this afternoon. So let's just go through the initial stages. Your approach by a director with a script or whatever, how does it start?
That's the start. In my case, it's nearly always been the director that has selected me, but quite often it's the company, let's say in the case of the RSC or the National, it's maybe the company that contact you as to whether you'd be free and want to do it. And on quite a few occasions, it's been from somebody I've never met before, so we meet to see how we get on, hopefully show them a bit of work, whatever. But a lot of the work is from people who've seen my work or know of me. So that's the first kickoff, is the invitation, if you like, to do the job. And I'm sure it's the same in any discipline. That invitation is what really gives you the kick to be able to do it. And I think in a way that's why perhaps a lot of other jobs, even in the creative world, would not have suited me, because if I had to bid for a job, then I wouldn't have the confidence to pull it off.
Yes.
I really wouldn't. It's the initial burst of absolute pride and confidence that somebody wants me.
Yes.
That's what kicks in. As you probably realise from everything else I've been saying, that doesn't hold up for very long. The minute you have a little downward bit, I certainly panic. I think perhaps I've started panicking much more in my later years than I used to as a youngster. But I suppose that's inevitable. You just have the courage when you're younger. And there's less riding on it. However, yes, the first go-off is an introduction. Would you either like to do this existing piece or we're doing a new piece? And so all that goes on. Meanwhile, the behind-the-scenes stuff is basically agents negotiating contracts and fees and all of that malarkey. But meanwhile, you begin the creative process. Obviously, it's quite different if I'm doing both sets and costumes as to when I'm doing just costumes, because the concept of, as simple as what period are we going to do it in, if it's an already existing piece, or, do we want it to look cartoon, or, do we want it to look as if it's in period, or all of those things can happen in many ways. If I'm doing costumes, it may be that I come in after that concept's already been developed by the set designer and the director, or I can come in right at the beginning, which is much more fun.
Yeah.
It just depends on the timing and on when they've asked me to do it. And whether it's because I'm the first port of call, or whether they may have had somebody else do it who's pulled out, or all sorts of things can happen.
Sure.
So the initial thing is you work on the concept. Now, at the same time, of course, you take into consideration, is it a tiny studio theatre in Chichester, in which case, we haven't got any money, we'll just have to do what we can, and not much space either. Or is it a big touring production, in which case that's important. And also, is it going to just play one season, or might it, all of those considerations are there. Money is a big one, a huge one. I mean, not, and always has been. I mean, there's never been enough money to do productions, and never enough money for anything, is there? But and it's totally relative. There wasn't enough money to do the Lohengrin in Bayreuth because it's so huge, even though they have fabulous resources. There wasn't enough money for the show I did at Chichester, which was about Lee Miller. There wasn't enough money for Draftsman's Contract, which, funnily enough, is why they're all in calico and cotton. We couldn't afford any other fabrics. We could only afford things that were really cheap.
Yes.
And rather than use cheap, nasty fabrics, we decided it would be much nicer to well, in a way I decided it, very influenced by Philip Prowse, I have to say, that actually at least if I used calico and occasional bits of silk, which sometimes you could get quite cheaply anyway, then at least we could paint it and it would have a sort of sculptural feel rather than using nasty cheap fabrics that don't do anything. But anyway, yes, the budget is of course important because that's where you basically need to set your scale as to what your ambition of design can be. And in some cases, it's so radical that you have to, the design concept has to actually contain a radical lack of budget. You know, for instance, you maybe use old clothes.
So do you find on those occasions when you're, I mean, as you've already said, I mean, the arts generally tend to be under-budgeted. Unless you are Kubrick, and then you obviously get everything. But generally speaking, it's under-budgeted. Do you find that given those circumstances, you find that a sort of creative challenge?
I don't think it hurts. There are times when you actually simply just heartbreakingly can't do what should be done for the piece. And also, it's very, very difficult with things like opera. You just simply cannot have less people because musically it won't stand up. You know, and whatever you dress a chorus in costs a certain amount of money. As you said, the amount of people on stage, more or less the same in musicals. You know, they can't have too few people, otherwise you can't... The music doesn't work, and you can't hear them, you know, even with sound systems.
Yeah.
More crucially, not prophecy, because they're not sounded, so to speak. As I say, I think every show I've done, with the exception of one, which was The Hunchback of Notre Dame, I did the costumes for... a Disney co-production in Berlin. And I have to say, there probably were budget restrictions, but it was such a big piece, they didn't come my way. I sort of pretty much got everything I wanted. It was chaos trying to do it, but I must admit it turned into a lot of fun in the end and looked great, I thought. But that had a lot of resources thrown at it, an awful lot.
What's the ratio these days between costume and set design? I mean, I know that...
I don't know whether I could...
Is it most... Well, I mean, now you are known as a costume designer first and foremost.
Yes, I think I probably
when
am.
When was the last time that you were responsible for set as well? Was it?
Funnily enough, the one we're reviving now in Birmingham is set designer as mine as well. I'm trying to think now, when was the last? I did Chichester, Six Lives of Lee Miller, I did that, sets for that. I've had revivals... Midsummer Night's Dream, which I designed both set and costumes for. That's gone on a few times.
I mean, do you miss not doing as
sometimes,
much?
Yes. Yes.
Would you be in complete control, set and costumes, or do you never do the two?
Oh, I've often
done both.
The only time I never did.
So that gives you complete control, really, of the visual spectacle, really, apart from the lighting, obviously, and...
No, apart from the shows I did with Maria back in the 70s, I've never not done my own costumes. So anything I've designed the set for, I've also done the costumes. Both ways round, it's a hard question, and what a nice one to not know the answer to, because working with another designer, and we're quite a small world, designers, so we all tend to either know of each other or know each other. And designers as a breed across... all the disciplines of design are, quite frankly, bloody nice people, normally, you know. So the chance of you working with somebody who isn't going to be a joy to be swapping ideas with, not to mention eating after the rehearsal, or you know, is unlikely. But also creatively, two heads is an extraordinary thing to have together. Yes. Yeah. And I've had great working relationships with all the set designers I've worked with, many of whom are costume designers in their own right as well. But I must admit, being in sole charge, especially in a big theatre, I mean, doing it, the shows at ENO and Opera North, where you're doing the set and the costumes, it's great fun.
Well,
you know, it's a lot of work, mind you. But the costume thing also has its own world. It's so beguiling. And when you're only doing the costumes, a lot rides on the drawings for me then, because that's all I've got to show up until we get some... costumes produced, so I think that puts a lot of emphasis on the drawings for myself that I could well do without, actually. It kind of panics me a bit in that point of view. Once I start fittings and things like that, it rolls along.
Well, having looked at your drawings over the last couple of weeks and then relating them to productions, which I've only seen through films,
I know, I haven't got enough photographs, actually.
They're remarkable in their sort of accuracy. And I mean, you tend to draw in a very... they look very immediate. I mean, they have a sort of fluidity in them.
Oh, thank you.
About them.
Thank you for that.
They do. And then you see them in the flesh, as it were, and you can immediately see the connection. So that you obviously have got something in your mind that you can get across and translate into reality.
I think that's the other reason why quite often doing the drawings is a painful experience.
Yeah.
Very painful, is because through experience I've learned how difficult it can be if you haven't got your concept right and you haven't drawn it how you want it to look. It would be better not to draw it at all and just make it up as you go along, which is sometimes the case with contemporary pieces and pieces that have absolutely no money. You might just have to do them from junk shops and charity shops, or you know, find some way of doing them, which has its own fun as well. That's great. But quite frankly, if you're going to do a drawing, it may as well be what it's going to look like, because then the artist who's going to wear it knows what they're going to look like.
Of course.
The director knows what it's going to look like.
Yeah.
Very, very importantly in musicals, the ballet and opera as well, the choreographer knows what they're going to look like. And you can have serious discussions as to whether they can move in them, whether, you know, all of that side of things. So it's actually, it makes life a lot easier to do drawings that do look as you would wish the production to look.
Well, I think...
It's not necessary, but it's easier.
You said just...
when you've done them.
You said just a little earlier about two minds being put together, and I just wanted to touch on relationships with directors, and one in particular that you've actually worked with on seven productions. That's Jonathan Miller, who's got a pretty big mind.
Yes.
He's
extraordinary. Yes.
And let's just talk about one production in particular, and that is The Mikado, which is still running and has been running ever since that was
86, right? I think. Yeah.
Very successfully and extraordinary looking, because it's set in the 1930s, if I remember rightly. With
correct.
Some very, very outrageous costumes. How did that come about, and what was the relationship between you and Jonathan Miller in the creation of the look of the... Because the costumes play a very big part.
They do. And again, with the magnificent set from Stefan Lazaridis, who just put a canvas up for me to paint onto. I mean, it's just wonderful, wonderful. Mm. The concept of the hotel 1930s setting, I think you'd have to talk to Stefan and Jonathan Miller to hammer that one out.
Sure.
I'm pretty sure it was Stefan's idea to set it in a white hotel, but it was very, very much Jonathan's concept to base it on the Marx Brothers and set it in the 30s. I mean, you know, and his whole thing, you know, Gentlemen of Japan, oh, we're not having any of that rubbish, you know, we just sort that one out when we get to it. And just his actual humour is just so wonderful in there. So the concept was very much already established when I came on board for that. And so we just started thinking of people to base each costume on, you know. In the men's lineup, there's a Diaghilev, there's a this and the other, you know, the rich banker, you know, it's just great fun.
And of course,
again, quite difficult for me to get to the point of issuing finished drawings.
Sure.
I kept thinking, well, they're going to be so boring.
Yeah.
You know, they're just in all ordinary sort of period clothes.
Yeah.
You know, shouldn't we be doing something more fun with it? But, you know, again, Jonathan's so persistent. He said, no, stick to the concept. It's going to work. It's going to be fabulous. You know, encourages you on. And it was great. It was a joy to work on.
And of course, you've done seven productions.
I know.
So you obviously got on very well.
And I love Jonathan's company. I mean, he's just Renaissance man, isn't he? I mean...
He's back in the ENO now.
I know.
Just now.
You haven't seen it, have you?
No, I haven't. No,
it's Bohem.
No, I did hear reviews.
Wish he'd asked me to do it, but he didn't.
Yes.
There you go.
Yeah. I think he's based it on black and white photographs.
Yes.
From
Cartier-Bresson.
Cartier-Bresson.
Yes.
No, I'm sure
we did that with Carmen a lot, actually.
Yes, well, I have seen Carmen, and I remember that.
I think he's brilliant, Jonathan. I mean, I must admit, the luck or the fortune of my career is the people I've worked with. I mean, my goodness. They're all
well. Another
just some stunning brains
well,
that I've worked
another
with.
Another person
you know.
Who you've worked with, who's in the news today, of course, is Roman Polanski.
Oh, is he? I haven't heard it.
Well,
today.
He wants to go back to America, and there's a court case today to see whether the case against him can be dropped after all those years. But of course, you've created the costumes for Dance of the Vampires, which is. I think it's still running
in a place called Oberhausen in Germany. Oh, it's a wonderful show. I love it. I'm very fond of nearly all the shows I've done. There's a few that I could do without, but very few indeed. And I think it is like having children doing a show. I don't have any children of my own, and I think those are all my babies, and I love them just like you would love children.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I've known designers before who they don't have children, and, you know, it's very clear to me that, you know, the whole process of creating, going through the development and finally producing a piece of creativity is like, it becomes very much their children. It's a long, arduous, emotional process.
Yes. Mind you, having said that, yourself included, there's a lot of genius designers who do have children and still manage to create wonderful, wonderful magic. But I think perhaps it may be part of my style, I suppose, is that the one thing I do is get incredibly involved emotionally with the piece. Mm. And depending on what it is, involved with the artists who I'm dressing or the or the people who are building the set or the people who are painting or certainly costume, wig, makeup, you know, all of that, all of those wonderful, talented people, you know, it's very engrossing.
Sure. Yeah. Well, when you're not, when you do have moments in between shows, what do you do to relax? What other interests do you have? What do you...
Right at the moment, trying to clear out boxes and settle in here. Do you know, I'm always busy. I don't know that I've ever not got anything to do.
You're looking at the dates. You seem to, as I said, you know, in those 35 years, you know, 82 productions, I'm sure there's been very little gap.
There hasn't. I mean, there's a gap now. I mean, I've got the ballet coming on in Birmingham, which opens next week. And after that, I do have a gap, quite a long one at the moment, which is not such good news. And I think everybody thinks I've retired ever since I got the MBE. I've got a theory about it. Moved to the country and got an MBE, that's it. Curtains for Blaine. But actually, I've never particularly had hobbies. No. There's lots I would like to have had, but I haven't. I must admit, that plus the social life that goes with a life in the theatre basically...
That's
completely
enough.
Filled me up for years and years and years and years. Things may be very different now I'm down here, and once I do get this place straight, I must admit there's a lot of sort of craft side of arts that I'd quite like to pursue. I'd love to do proper painting. I'd love to maybe learn portraiture. Love to learn a language, or at least manage. You know, there's so many things I'd like to do, as we all think, don't we?
Well, let's just end on the possibility of, you know, various young hopefuls that might be listening to this, and any advice you might want to give them, because it's a very successful world that you inhabit now. It's hard work.
It is hard work.
And strapped for cash and all those things. But what would you say? I'm sure, you know, there's still many young designers going into theatre design and costume design, you know, wanting to follow very much in the same footsteps that you've done. What sort of advice would you give them?
If it's pre-training, I personally, but this is, I'm biased here, I would say that doing theatre design as opposed to specifically costume design, if you want to work in theatre, I think is much better, because I think the three-dimensionality of costume on a stage is what I enjoy, as well as the emotional interpretive side of it. I love the fact that I'm making shapes on a stage. That's why I love doing ballet or musicals as well as straight theatre. But if you want to go into films, TV, whatever, then perhaps as a costumer, then costume designer, maybe a concentrated costume course would be better. But the overall advice I'd give would probably be the same as Bill Kimpton said to me, don't give up. You know, in other words, you've got to hold your ground. Mm. And many, many young designers who absolutely have to find work doing something go and assist other designers and all the rest of it. Very hard when you're earning money to then not earn anything to design a show of your own. So it's a very big temptation is to carry on assisting. Mm. And after a certain amount of time, it's very difficult to break that mould in the perception of everybody around you. Mm. So if you really, really want to be a designer, you've just got to hang in there. Mm. And also don't jump before, don't think I've got to work at the National with Nick Heitner or the RSC with... Yeah. The most famous directors, what you've got to do is meet your own contemporaries who will grow up with you, who will be the future directors, the future writers. Writers are very important as well, of course. Yes, I mean, that's, absolutely. You know, goodness me. Absolutely. We wouldn't have much theatre without them. But, you know, so, and in a way I can sort of understand maybe my feeling about art school is you go there to learn art, but perhaps the university degrees are more interesting because you're going to meet people in the other disciplines and that make your contacts there. But it's pretty important to really do the stuff that doesn't pay in order to get to know the people. Mm. And that's a tough one.
Yes.
It's a very tough one.
Okay, on that note, Sue Blain, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.